It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's prison system is facing controversy over lockdowns and inmate deaths. Now, healthcare in Wisconsin prisons goes under the microscope.
A recent New York Times and Wisconsin Watch investigation followed the work histories of the prison system's 60 medical professionals. They found that a third of corrections department physicians have faced disciplinary actions during their medical careers.
That report comes 1 month after a former warden of Waupun Correctional Institution and 8 other prison employees were charged in connection with multiple inmate deaths over the last year.
Wisconsin Today recently spoke with Megan Hoffman Kolb. Her father, Dean Hoffman, died by suicide in solitary confinement while at the Waupun facility in 2023. Her family has filed a wrongful death lawsuit alleging that prison staff did not provide Hoffman psychiatric medication.
After my dad died, I wouldn't be able to sleep because I could see him in his cell and the mental anguish he was going through.
Milwaukee-based reporter Mario Coran has been covering the state correction system for Wisconsin Watch. He's also a local investigations fellow for the New York Times. Mario, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Your investigation says 17 of the state's 60 corrections physicians were censured in the past decade. Can you talk about what that means? What kind of activities had gotten those doctors censured at some point in their career?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Those numbers are correct. 17 out of the 60 full-time doctors employed by DOC, Department of Corrections, have faced some kind of reprimand. And those reasons for reprimand really range. They range from the relatively minor, haphazard record-keeping practices in a couple of cases to much more severe allegations of medical negligence that resulted in death. In one case, conviction by court-martial for sexual assault of a patient under a doctor's care. The vast majority, and I think in all but one of those cases, the doctors in question were disciplined before they went to work for the Department of Corrections. So these were on the records, but they were, in fact, hired regardless.
That's just shy of one third. When we look at doctors in general, how common is this kind of reprimand or censure? Is it that common among doctors to have that high a proportion?
Well, I don't have the rate for current doctors working and how many doctors working currently have faced discipline. But what we do know is that this is a very rare occurrence of all the doctors in Wisconsin in the past. I think from 2019 to 2022, only about 1.23% of these doctors have been reprimanded. So when we're looking at it by proportion, the doctors working for Department of Corrections certainly are a much higher proportion of doctors who have had these types of problems.
How did you go about gathering information about these prison physicians?
Well, it started with a simple list of all the doctors that had been working, and in fact, it led to just looking these doctors up individually. Sometimes this took the work of going to individual states, tracking down the medical records from Kansas or California. Wherever these doctors started working. And luckily, there is record of disciplinary actions across states. So it's really just comparing the list of doctors to the list of disciplinary orders that are already out there. And it didn't take long to start finding matches between the two.
One of the big concerns now, of course, is the quality of medical care at Wisconsin's prisons. Are there concerns? What kind of worries are we seeing about the health care that people in prisons are getting?
Yeah, I mean, this is a story that really kind of highlights the deeper systemic problems of things that we've seen a lot of this year. So, we started this segment with Megan Hoffman, whose father, of course, died in Waupun. So we have just over the past year seen so many allegations of negligence, of medical malpractice happening not just at Waupun, but across the prison system. And so when we're looking at a medical system that has been struggling, already straining, and we sort of peel back the curtain, we look at the number of doctors who have been disciplined, it puts these questions in stark relief. It puts these questions, really highlights these questions.
we've talked in the past, Mario, about staffing problems at Wisconsin's correctional institutions. Is there a similar thing going on with doctors where, hey, we're having a hard time hiring, we may have to take what we can get?
I mean, that is the sense. I spoke with medical experts, including experts who have at one point sat on the Wisconsin Medical Board. I spoke with the former chairman of that. And that really is the sense that, hey, look, we have this profession. We have healthcare positions in prison, which aren't seen always as the most desirable. They're often seen as dangerous. These are difficult places often to recruit quality healthcare professionals. And so when we're looking at sort of filling those holes, the question is it better to have no doctor at all, or is it better to have a doctor who struggled to have the to who has struggled in the past? And that is the way the question has been framed by a number of experts who I've spoken to. So it's not an easy problem to solve by any means. But the fact is, it's not a new problem. This has been going on for at least a decade, and actually longer than that. And it's one that Department of Correction has known about. So we really have seen very little progress, very little traction on addressing this issue.
We could imagine, hey, maybe a doctor had a rough patch in the past. They've paid their debt. They could potentially be a good physician. You talked, I think, in your report, Mario, to one physician who made that case, at least in their own story. Is that a possibility? We could see doctors turn around and do a good job in our prisons.
Yeah, you're correct. That's certainly the take of one of the doctors. I should be clear that I did reach out to every doctor I mentioned in the story, but really only one got back to me. And that was his take. Like, look, this is I was struggling with sobriety at the time. I was struggling with drug and alcohol use. I owned it. I addressed the issue, did everything I needed to do. And I came back and had a long career. And it's his perspective that, look, you know, we, this a doctor like myself does have the ability to address these problems, go on to provide quality care, and perhaps in ways that doctors who haven't struggled with insights that doctors who haven't struggled might not have. So yes, that is a take that I heard.
Talking to Mario Coran with Wisconsin Watch and the New York Times about his investigation into Wisconsin correctional institutions. About a third, just shy of a third of physicians there had been censured at some point in their careers. Mario, you start off your piece with a close look at Darnell Price and a misdiagnosis or a missed diagnosis. Can you share that story?
Sure. Yes. I start the piece with the story of Darnell Price. Darnell Price was incarcerated, serving a prison sentence at Stanley Correctional Facility. Darnell Price started with a lump on his leg, and really was, when you're in prison as a prisoner, you can't just go to the doctor's office, right, and have them checked out. You have to submit a form and request that type of care. The doctors at the prison, he has it in black and white that he had submitted request after request to have this lump checked out on his thigh. We see months go by, in this case, 10 months, without proper testing of what that lump actually is. And by the time he leaves that prison, without having it treated, it has grown to the size of a football. And when he moves to a new prison, doctors do test it. And not only is it cancerous, but it has by that point spread to his internal organs. And doctors gave him only 2 to 3 years to live. So he has since been released, compassionate released, and is in the community. But, you know, really his story is not over. He's, you know, the toughest part of his story is yet to come, unfortunately.
I want to key in on Waupun Correctional Institution, Mario, as we've mentioned in the news for a lot of the wrong reasons lately. Wisconsin Today talked to Teresa Hewlett last week. Her son Damian is serving a 21-year sentence at Waupun. Here she is talking about conditions there.
It just tells me of how horrible it is in there and how inhumane they treat people. Correctional officers are there to do their job, and they don't. They treat these people very badly.
Mario, can you paint us a picture of conditions at Waupun now with staffing shortages? We had those long-running lockdowns, these concerns about medical care. What's going on?
Yeah, I think it's worth just pausing for a moment to consider a year-long lockdown and just how unprecedented and how rare that is for prisoners to be confined essentially to their cells for much of the day, if not 24 hours. You know, we have heard reports, we have heard statements from the Department of Corrections that those conditions have lightened up a bit, but really that the calls, the tone that I've gotten from calls and emails and letters from prisoners at Waupun is really a tone of desperation, a sense that they have these requests sometimes for medical emergencies are being ignored. So we had those reports, we had those allegations already, and what we saw in the past in recent weeks is those types of allegations actually leading to criminal charges of medical neglect, of deliberate indifference, of calls for help being ignored to the point that they resulted in death. So it is not, I think it's very, makes it that much harder to dismiss the complaints coming from inside.
Mario, in our last few minutes, moments, I should say, what are you watching for next as you continue to coverage the correctional system?
Well, I am, you know, I'm going to continue to follow the sort of fallout from these criminal charges that have come down at Waupun and really see what happens there. I'm also looking for a little bit of, I'm looking for some of the responses from lawmakers, from Governor Evers' office, has yet to comment on any of the allegations in the story. So really, you know, from a journalist standpoint, I'm just hoping for some response. And somebody to take up some of these questions and provide responses.
Mario, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mario Caran is a reporter for Wisconsin Watch. He's currently a New York Times Local Investigations Fellow examining Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. Is this a story that's affecting your life or that of a loved one, whether they're incarcerated in Wisconsin's prison system now or employed there? Love to hear your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, with rising costs, some municipalities around Wisconsin face tough budget cuts and have to ask local taxpayers for more money.
Since the pandemic and the inflation, that really kind of broke our back, and I think broke the backs of a lot of communities throughout the state.
We hear from two communities ahead on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Next week, thousands of people will journey to Milwaukee for the 2024 Republican National Convention. As WPR's Evan Casey reports, the true economic impact for the region is still unclear.
On a humid Tuesday in late June, Ryan Cook is sitting outside of the Broad House, the restaurant he operates that's just one block away from Pfizer Forum. Cook and other local business owners have been preparing for the RNC for several months. Now, it's just days away.
We're anticipating it creating a lot of hassle, but bringing a lot of business.
That's an attitude shared by some establishments who believe the extra foot traffic will be good for business. Cook hopes the convention is something similar to what the restaurant saw 3 years ago when the Milwaukee Bucks won the NBA championship.
We're hoping the RNC brings out something like that, but there's going to be other caveats where there's certain times where we're closed to the public for private buyouts.
Organizers say the four-day event will bring upwards of 50,000 visitors to the city. They have also said it'll have an estimated economic impact of $200 million. That's from hotel stays, restaurant tabs, and other spending. Peggy Williams-Smith is the president and CEO of Visit Milwaukee. She says hosting the convention will make other big events more likely to choose Milwaukee in the future.
It's just the perfect storm of people being interested in coming to Milwaukee.
But some local business owners and some economists don't believe the hype. Victor Matheson is an economics professor at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts. His 2017 study looked at the economic impact of national political conventions. He says the real economic impact will likely be just a fraction of that $200 million figure.
These are wildly disruptive events. Regular business can often plummet around these events.
Matheson says some restaurants could have less business because of the security perimeter, too.
The other problem is that lots of the economic impact that occurs is not sticking in Milwaukee, but is instead leaving town. So higher hotel prices, that doesn't necessarily benefit Milwaukee. It benefits national headquarters of those hotel chains.
Cleveland hosted the Republican convention in 2016. That was the last presidential contest before the pandemic disrupted the 2020 conventions. A study from Cleveland State University found the economic impact of that year's convention was around $142 million instead of the projected $200 million. But Dan Gilbert, CEO of the RNC Host Committee in 2016, says hosting the event helped the city win other bids since the convention. That includes the MLB and NBA All-Star Games and the NFL Draft.
I do believe it's certainly a part of the story of, you know, Cleveland now really being considered year in and year out one of the top cities in America for hosting major events.
Some local venues and event spaces say they've been rented out during the convention, but others have complained they didn't get any extra business. That includes Gary Witt, who operates a few theaters in Milwaukee, including the Pabst and the Riverside. He says he had hoped to book several events at his venue spaces the week of the event.
But essentially, we sit today, as a lot of other spaces are in the city of Milwaukee, basically unused and empty during a time period when we were specifically told to hold those dates open.
Shane Abramson works at Brick 3 Pizza, just around the corner from Pfizer Forum. He said he believes the event will be good for downtown Milwaukee businesses. But in the meantime, he says the restaurant lost business in June. That's because Pfizer Forum hosted no events while the arena was being set up for the convention.
No events 1 month prior, no events 1 month after for breakdown and setup. So that hurt us big time.
The convention starts on Monday. Many of the tens of thousands of visitors will be arriving this weekend. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You'll hear coverage across WPR News throughout the week of the convention and this week as we preview what's happening and the effects on Milwaukee and on Wisconsin.
Tune in to hear coverage on Wisconsin today. You'll also hear headlines across WPR News. And as you're looking for the top news from around the state in one quick listen, check out WPR's podcast called Wisconsin Today Morning News. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts or go online at WPR.org.
Now, municipalities across Wisconsin continue to grapple with budget challenges as local revenues fall short of rising operating costs. Last year, the state legislature passed a law that overhauled Wisconsin's shared revenue system, providing an increase in funding for local governments.
But that increase may not be enough for communities to balance their budgets. Some are turning to referendums to raise local tax levies and keep services fully funded. We're checking in now on those referendum efforts and the financial dilemmas on the horizon.
Martin Shanks is the village administrator in Oregon, south of Madison. His village board recently voted to move forward with plans for a referendum next spring. Martin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Could you walk us through what kind of budget shortfall you're projecting in Oregon over the next few years?
Yeah, so we've been doing some long-range financial analysis over the next 10 years, and we've really looked at 2026, 2027 as about a little over half a million to a million, depending on any number of factors, that our expenses will be outrunning our revenues at that point. And so we're hoping that right now we're evaluating the possibility of a referendum in April 2025. We're going through that process right now, and we'll see where that takes us.
It seems like 2026, 2027 is far off, but in the budget world and in your planning processes, that isn't actually that far away.
No, and for our, the property tax being our main source of revenue, we can only go to that well once a year, obviously. So once we set it for, you know, at the end of the year, we get it, and that's what we get for the year. So we're really only, you know, two cycles away from where we think we're going to be in that shortfall.
What are the primary forces here? What is driving up costs for the village?
Over the last 5-6 years, you know, since the pandemic and then the inflation, that really kind of broke our back, and I think broke the backs of a lot of communities throughout the state, where, you know, our main source of revenue here, the property tax, is limited to new construction. You know, we can only raise it based on new construction value created in our communities. And, you know, as Oregon, we do all right. We're a suburb of Madison, but most of our growth is residential. And, of course, residents create more services, more demand on public services, you know, police calls, fire calls, EMS calls, more streets to fix, more parks, that sort of thing. And when you're only able to get maybe 1-3% increase on your property tax levy, and you're doing that in the face of, you know, 5-8%, 10% inflation, plus your community is growing on top of that, pretty much everything we're doing is outrunning our source of revenue.
Enter the state legislature, which updated the shared revenue system last year, which sends more of that state funding to smaller communities like yours. How much a difference will that make?
So we got close to $300,000 out of that law, which is great. It's nice and appreciated. But really, when you look back, you know, going back 20 years, if you look at our state shared revenues that we received in 2003, you know, they were at just over $400,000. And we really lost almost $200,000 of that over those 20 years. And so this $300,000 that we got is sort of, it's a nice backfill for the stuff that we lost all the over these 20 years and a little bit on top of that. But really, it's just getting us back to where we were 20 years ago, plus a little bit better.
We're talking with Martin Shanks, administrator for the Village of Oregon, as we look at state shared revenue and ongoing municipal budget challenges. Martin, what kind of options do you have on the table for trying to reduce costs or to increase revenues?
Yeah, we've looked at that over the last couple of years in detail here. And, you know, we've, in terms of the revenue side, we've pretty much pulled on all of the lower hanging fruit that are available to local governments. We use the wheel tax. We did some fees and some other things that we put into place. So really the only things that are left on the revenue side are things that if we do it, we will have to make an adjustment on our property tax levy anyways. So, you know, we're not really getting any farther ahead there. Or there are things that are going to create a bunch of administrative overhead and costs that you know, we would have to accommodate as well. So we're sort of out of revenue options that are going to make a significant difference. On the expenditure side, you know, our community doesn't really have a whole lot of bells and whistles. I mean, we do police, fire, EMS, public works, a little bit of parks. We don't have a recreation department. That's handled by our school district. We have a senior center and a library, and that's really all we do. I mean, those are some pretty basic services. And so there's not a lot. We can't reduce enough without really having an impact on the current services that are provided.
You are still in the process as a community of deciding, you know, for a referendum and in that planning process. But do you have a broader message you're hoping to send to the community in a potential lead up to the vote?
No, I think the challenges for going through this process are helping people understand why, you know, this is taking place. You know, I think school districts have sort of been in this cycle for a little while, but this is relatively new for a lot of local governments. And it's hard to capture sort of the history of how we got here and how sort of some of the different elements of this play out, and then why it's needed, because Otherwise, the things that you enjoy, the services that you enjoy, the high quality of life that we certainly have in our community and in Dane County and throughout the state, may not. We have to have a serious conversation about what's realistic and what's not if we're not going to have these referendums.
Mm-hmm. It begs the question, how do you fund local governments in more sustainable, long-term ways? What does a sustainable future look like in terms of budget?
I think the way that the law is currently written, I don't think that that's a tenable future for any local government in terms of actual sustainability. I think you can look at the school districts as a model for where local governments are headed. You're going to have to keep going back to referendum periodically in order to continue to support your existing services, or to try to, if you want to do something new or even add something, you're almost certainly going to have to do that.
Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Martin Shanks is administrator for the Village of Oregon in Dane County. He was with us to discuss the budgetary challenges facing his municipality and potential plans for a referendum next year. Other communities have already gone to referendum to increase their tax levy. But what happens when local voters say no? In northern Wisconsin, leaders in Forest County are working through those next steps after voters rejected their referendum. Ron Skalrud is chair of the Forest County Board of Supervisors. Ron, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you for having me on your program this day.
How does Forest County find itself in its current budget situation? What does it look like?
Well, our current budget situation is going to be tenuous at best moving forward. In 2020, this year, 2024, we had gone through the process of a referendum. So we were asking for a referendum of a levy increase up to $2 million moving forward so that we could meet future budget goals for the services that a county has to provide. We're a rural county located in northern Wisconsin, full-time residents of about a little over 9,000. We're also in a unique situation in which only 17% of our county is taxable. We have a lot of national forest land, but yet we have to provide services to that land as well. We also have two tribal nations within our community, which are excellent partners with us and have been also contributing for services above and beyond the compact requirements. So they've been great partners, but once again, that's untaxable lands. Where counties get its money through its main source of revenue is obviously the property taxation. And then if you include managed forest land and agricultural land, which reduces the burden on taxes for property taxes for the individuals, if you really calculated that out, about only 10% of our county is fully taxable.
I want to pause right there because Forest County, as you said, home to almost 350,000 acres of national forest land as part of the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. And does the county get any alternative funding from the government for those acres in lieu of property taxes?
So there is some funding in lieu of property taxes, nowhere near to the amount that we would receive in standard property levy. So, and the townships actually get a little bit more of a portion of that than the county itself. So it's really insubstantial for a trade-off, which is hence why our county, I believe, has felt the impact at the county level sooner than any other county has with the tax levy freeze limits and so forth. So we went to referendum, and at our April election is when we went on to posing that question to our tax base, our citizens, and it failed about 70% to 30%. So it did not pass. So that means this upcoming year, we are going to have to really start looking at what services are we going to be cutting back? How are we going to manage things? Trying to avoid things like layoffs, trying to offer as many of the services that a county is mandated to offer, but counties also offer services that are not mandated through legislation. So we're hoping to find a way, as we're continuing our budget process right now, to have the least impact on services available and trying not to have to eliminate departments that are non-mandatory departments.
Looking at Forest County here with Board Chair Ron Skalrud as we talk about what happens after a tax levy referendum fails. Ron, how does the state shared revenue formula play into this for Forest County? What have you found?
So what we found is this year we were able to offset our tax levy increase by about $249,000. That goes to public safety, but then counties are able to redistribute the savings across other departments and so forth. So that's what we are doing right now with that. We're optimistic to see what happens with the new shared revenue as opposed to past legislation. This has a built-in potential to continue to increase each year. 2025 is the first year we're going to see how that works with the actual implementation of the state.
Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ron Skalrud is the chair of the Forest County Board of Supervisors, and he joined us to share how his board is preparing for looming budget shortfalls after a referendum to increase the tax levy failed earlier this year. We also heard from the Village of Oregon Administrator Martin Shanks about how his community south of Madison is planning for a referendum to cover rising operating costs.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, catch up with a traveling Shakespeare company performing in Wisconsin parks where sounds of nature and city life are just part of the deal.
We all, the actors on stage and the people in the audience, have to acknowledge that we're in this environment where anything can happen.
It's the Starling Shakespeare Company up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is a moment of Shakespeare.
By innocence, I swear, and by my youth, I have one heart, one bosom, and one truth.
That's from the Shakespeare play Twelfth Night, performed there by Kristen Yates of the Starling Shakespeare Company. They're a migratory theater troupe that travels the Great Lakes region, giving free performances of Shakespeare in the park.
We caught up with Starling performers in Ripon, where they just kicked off their season. Jessie Lillis is an actor and director. She's the producing artistic director and co-founder of Starling Shakespeare Company. And Kristen Yates is a professional stage actor. It's her first season with the company. Jessie and Kristen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Well, Jessie, you first, as you've been rehearsing in Ripon, just had your first performance of the season a couple weeks back. How is it going?
Really well. It's always such a treat to get to come back. I went to undergrad in Wisconsin at Ripon College, so it's such a delight to get to come back many moons later with the Shakespeare Company. But it's been really nice to get to come back, and it's always such a warm welcome from the community and the town and everybody we get to interact with here.
And Kristen, you've performed with other Shakespeare companies. This is your first summer touring with Starling. What has it been like so far for you?
It's been such a treat. I am very excited to be here. I learned about Starling through some really close friends who I've worked with at other Shakespeare companies, and they spoke extremely highly of the company and of Jessie. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to audition. And so I'm just really grateful to be here and experience how they approach Shakespeare, which is in a very approachable way for the actor. And the process has been very mindful about making sure that the actors have the ability to express themselves artistically and bring themselves to Shakespeare.
That must be so important, too, not just to have the accessibility and that modern look at Shakespeare, but also to bring your personal influences and your personal take to what Shakespeare is. Kristen, it sounds like you're able to do that.
Yeah. It's definitely something where we're not hiding who we are. It's not a thing of, oh, you know, you have to fit what, you know, for example, because we're doing Twelfth Night as one of the shows, you have to fit this idea of Viola. I, as Kristen, get to bring myself to Viola. So Viola, my version of Viola, has a lot of Kristen in it, which is really lovely because I think it makes it so that Shakespeare will always be new and interesting, because whoever's playing the roles, it will be slightly different every time. So it's really exciting to get to discover who my Viola is.
Jesse, you co-founded Starling. This was back in 2020. What inspired you to start this theater company? And I'm thinking about 2020 as the pandemic year.
Yeah, I mean, it was, in retrospect, a little bit of a wild time to be starting a theater company when theater wasn't really existing. But I guess for context, so my co-founder, Heron Kennedy, and I, we finished our Masters of Fine Arts, our MFAs, in 2020. And we were sort of looking around at a lot of theaters that we had, you know, previously been planning on auditioning for and hoping to work with, and seeing a lot of those places, unfortunately, have to close their doors, often for kind of COVID-related financial issues, or there was a lot of upheaval happening in many industries, but especially in theater at that time. I had gone into my master's program knowing that eventually I wanted to start a company, but I honestly thought that would probably be, you know, 20, 30 years down the road before I did it. But it was sort of a confluence of events of getting, finally having a chance to take a break and think about, you know, what things are important to me as an artist. What are the sorts of things that I want to be making? Where are the places that I'm seeing needs for theater? And a lot of it for me, I'm from a small town in the Midwest, and I was thinking about, you know, as a kid, I was lucky in that I had access to a lot of theater and arts. I'm from a really artistic family, but I know a lot of people that didn't have that. And so I fell in love with Shakespeare at a pretty young age, but I know also that people sometimes have a bad experience with that, whether it's through, you know, English classes or seeing a show that they didn't like, or, you know, watching a movie interpretation that didn't land with them. So my sort of thought with starting Starling was that, you know, we can bring these really classic stories directly to people where they are. So we do touring shows. We try to keep them either low or no cost. We're doing Shakespeare in the Park style. Our shows in the summer are also done with only 5 actors. So I think that's something that artistically helps make the place feel a little bit more approachable. You know, you're not showing up and seeing 25 people in ruffs and collars, and they look so foreign to anything that's familiar. You know, you see 5 guys in sneakers run on stage, and we're all playing multiple parts. And the shows are very intentionally really playful and really accessible. So that's sort of been Starling's MO from the beginning, is, you know, how do we get people excited about this thing that we understand they might have some hesitations around.
I wonder then, why outdoors? Why does Shakespeare play well outdoors?
Oh, that's a great question. I think, honestly, some of it is that a lot of the plays were originally performed like that. So if we're thinking back historically, Shakespeare had 2 theaters. He had an indoor and an outdoor theater. So there is a lot of nature built into the plays, because we're referencing things like the sun when the sun is literally above our heads. I also think there's a sense of ease that comes with being outside. I think that, you know, when you have a group of people that are sitting on a picnic blanket, relaxing outside, I think it puts people at ease and willing to kind of have a little bit of suspension of disbelief and kind of join in the play. For us, the audience is, you know, our 6th cast member. We can't do the shows without them. And so we're really bringing them in. We're talking directly to them. We're, you know, sometimes having them literally interact with the actors and be in the play. And I think being in that more casual outdoor environment kind of invites that and creates that interactive environment that is really, really important and is baked into the text of Shakespeare, since, you know, they didn't have the ability to dim the lights and have the audiences sit in the dark, since that technology didn't exist.
Oh, that's really interesting to think about that. I wonder, too, Kristen, do you ever get distracted as an actor in the outdoor setting? Or how do you stay focused and yet you're at arm's length from that person sitting on a blanket in front of you?
Yeah, I think that for me personally, I thrive in that type of environment. Audience interaction is probably one of my favorite things about Shakespeare. And so I think not ignoring the fact that you're exhausted or that, like, you know, you're outside and you're sweating and things are happening and you can, like, share that with the audience and have those moments. And so I think the main thing is staying hydrated and, you know, stretching, like all those things to make sure that you're actually taking care of yourself being outside in the heat, but just incorporating the environment. And I think it helps to not have that idea of the fourth wall when something crazy like a fire truck starts going off or, you know, something happens where we all, the actors on stage and the people in the audience, have to acknowledge that we're in this environment where anything can happen. And so I think that helps include them even more because we're all in this together. We're all outside at this park, you know, doing this thing, whether that's being an actor or being in the audience as a part of the play.
We are talking about performing Shakespeare in the park in all the elements. Kristen Yates, their actor from the Starling Shakespeare Company, and Jesse Lillis from Starling as well. So you have brought us a sample from Twelfth Night. Jesse, set the stage for us, if you will.
Sure. So Twelfth Night is sort of Shakespeare's classic shipwreck, long-lost twins comedy. So in this situation, I guess, our heroine Viola is in disguise as the serving man to the Duke Orsino. So Viola has disguised herself as someone named Cesario. Cesario is going to court the Lady Olivia in the name of the Duke Orsino. But unfortunately for Duke Orsino, Olivia sees Cesario, the disguised Viola, and instantly becomes enamored. So in this scene, Olivia is really putting the moves on and trying to make some headway with Cesario. And Cesario slash Viola is doing her best to shut that down, since she herself is also in love with Duke Orsino. So it's a bit of a love triangle situation.
Well, take it away. Let's hear a sample.
Stay, I prithee, tell me what thou thinkst of me, that you do think you are not what you are.
If I think so, I think the same of you.
Then you think right. I am not what I am.
I would you were as I would have you be.
Would it be better, madam, than I am? I wish it might, for now I am your fool.
Cesario, by the roses of the spring, by maidhood, honor, truth, and everything, I love thee so that maugre all thy pride, nor wit nor reason can my passion hide. Do not extort thy reasons from this clause, for that I woo, thou therefore hast no cause. But rather, reason thus with reason fetter. Love sought is good, but given unsought better.
By innocence, I swear, and by my youth, I have one heart, one bosom, and one truth, and that no woman has, nor never none shall be mistress of it, but me alone. And so adieu, good madam. Nevermore will I my master's tears to you deplore.
Oh, yet come again, for thou perhaps mayst move that heart, which now abhors, to like his love.
That was brilliant. Oh, I love it. Thank you so much. It's like whiplash. I mean, Twelfth Night gives
it really
me
is.
Absolute whiplash for you. Okay, who is paired with who, you know, what their identity really is. And I yeah. think it harkens back, Jesse, to this ability then for Shakespeare, you know, to be able to really kind of cast gender blind. And I can see how that would work with Twelfth Night.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we talk a lot in sort of my background in Shakespeare is both performance and sort of academic and research focused. And so especially on the research end, there's a lot of work about, you know, who were the people that were actually performing these plays. And there were, you know, they had the boy players who would play a lot of the females' parts. But then you end up in these funny situations where maybe you have a young male actor who's playing Viola in disguise as a boy. So it's sort of this this funny little web of gender blind casting, which, you know, we're doing a lot of that in our shows too, with only five actors. Everybody's playing multiple roles and multiple genders that may or may not align with how they identify. So, you know, Kristen is playing Viola and also Viola's twin brother, Sebastian, and Viola in Cesario. So it's a pretty funny, and fun, interpretation and way to do the plays.
Jesse, you've got a big tour here ahead this summer, including this month-long residency on Mackinac Island in August. What is special to you about performing in the Midwest, and especially on Mackinac Island?
Yeah, so I'm from Michigan originally. My whole family is from various parts of the Midwest, so I have a lot of love for this whole region. So, you know, part of thinking about in putting the company together and thinking about doing outdoor Shakespeare, if I'm being honest, I don't love extreme heat. So that sort of automatically excluded certain areas of the country for summer Shakespeare because it's just too hot for me personally. But I think that, you know, there's so many beautiful outdoor spaces here. And there's also a lot of places where, you know, we have kind of major cities and major hubs where there's a lot of access to the arts, but there are so many smaller communities, including, you know, like the one that I'm from in Southwest Michigan, and other places where maybe there's certain things that people have access to, but having Shakespeare and having it right there in your backyard for free is not always the case. So I think it's really fun to get to bring these plays to places that maybe wouldn't have it. Every time I have, you know, I'll see little kids in the audience and I'm like, oh, that was me, you know, a lot of years ago. It's nice to see that. And with Mackinac Island specifically, I feel like this story almost sounds like it's fake, but I promise this is a true thing. So I used to go there as a kid. You know, we'd have school trips. My dad had conferences there, so we'd go up and have vacations on the island. And as a pretty young kid, I was in the park in front of the fort on the island. And I was like, boy, it seems like there should be Shakespeare in this park.
And
yeah, it's pretty wild. So I started really kind of thinking about that and formulating that idea when I was about 18, and a little over, I think it was about 12 years later, was our first season on the island. So that one was a long time coming.
That's such a special story. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Kristen, as we wrap up here, your first season performing with Starling, what are you most looking forward to as you go out on the tour?
I think I'm most excited to experience the different audiences and just to see how different age groups or different, you know, like cultures, like respond to Shakespeare and the story. I definitely enjoy performing for families and kids and seeing, you know, them get to have like this experience of Shakespeare in a different way with, you know, five people playing all the parts. I just think that there's something really special about that. And I think kids specifically, there's something about the way that their imagination is still working that they can really buy in. And so like, I think that those audiences are always a treat for me, but yeah, just to see how everyone responds to it.
Oh, Jesse and Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. All the best on these shows.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've been talking with Jesse Lillis, co-founder and artistic director of Starling Shakespeare Company, and actor Kristen Yates about their summer tour of the Midwest.
Starling is performing Henry IV in Green Lake on Saturday. You can find a list of performance dates and locations at starlingshakespearecompany.com.
A family-run newspaper in East Central Wisconsin is marking 125 years in business this month. We're going to find out how it's changed through the generations and its connection to the local communities that it serves.
According to a recent survey from Pew, Americans still see value in local news. We want to know, how do you feel about your local newspaper? Do you still have one? If one has gone away, do you miss its coverage and its place in your community, or not so much?
Call in. You can leave us a message. You can text us right now at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today, or email us, wisconsintoday@WPR.org.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.